Limited. Good morning. I am Yetta, and this is Shattering Myths, the program where we expose the beguiling and destructive myths associated with religion, politics, and patriotism, with military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news this morning, my mission will be to help you understand why these things are occurring and to share what you can do to protect yourself and your family, all while predicting what these events portend for our future. Then during our second hour, we're going to engage God on His terms by way of His covenant and through His one and only Torah, teaching us how to replace religion with reason. Our phone number for those who would like to engage in the discussion is 877-300-7645. Turning to the Middle East, we read the following report from the BBC. At least 25 people have died in the Gaza Strip as Israeli forces kept up their airstrike they say are aimed at stopping rocket attacks into Israel. The BBC is probably my least favorite media outlet. Now you say, well, why would you cite them if they're your least favorite? Because the purpose of this hour of our program is not only to present the myths that are being perpetrated by the news, but also to expose and condemn the newsmakers themselves. The BBC is just perhaps the worst of a bad lot. They are, in most of their reports, they talk about the distinguishing event of civilians dying in the Gaza Strip, recognizing that there is no such thing as a distinction between a militant and a civilian. In fact, all the militants are civilians. There is no military in the Gaza Strip. So 100% of the fatalities, even if they kill a Hamas chieftain, are civilian. And also, it is so utterly obvious that the only reason that people are dying in Gaza is because Hamas continues to fire rockets into Israel. No rockets into Israel, no retaliation for the rockets. It is that simple. Anyone that is even half-witted knows that, and yet what do they say? They have to say, the airstrikes, they say, are aimed at stopping rocket attacks in Israel. These repulsive pretend journalists want to make it look like Israel is the attacker, that they are the aggressor. And there is absolutely no rational or sane argument that can be made in that regard. But that's yet the presentation of most of the world because they hate Israel, because they hate the God of Israel. This journalistic article, and I put that in air quotes, next says, fewer rockets have been launched, but some have hit southern Israeli towns. Now, here's the truth. Militants in Gaza over the last week have fired more than 1,000 rockets at Israel. Roughly 550 of those rockets struck Israel, and 340 have been intercepted by Israel's defense shield, including 41 of the 146 that were fired in the last 24 hours. So over the last week, there have been 1,000 rockets, 146 of them fired on Sunday. And so this notion that fewer rockets have been launched is a lie. The whole purpose of that, to lie as part of a journalistic article, is to make it look like Israel's response is excessive. You know, you can mislead people either through precluding their ability to reason and exercise judgment or by corrupting the data that they are given. In this case, both are occurring. The cause and effect that is essential for understanding and for making sane decisions is corrupted by their presumptive statements in their opening comment, and then they corrupt the data line to their readers. Now, if you, by the way, were to add up 550 that have struck inside of Israel, 340 that have been intercepted, that does not total more than 1,000. What happened to the rest of them? Well, a little over 10% of the rockets that are Iranian-made and fired by Hamas militants actually land inside of the Gaza Strip. In other words, they kill their own with their own rockets. And of course, when they misfire a rocket and it lands on their own apartment buildings, they of course blame Jews and go off and cry and mourn and pretend that they have been assaulted. This article reads, 94 Palestinians and 3 Israelis have died since Wednesday. They include 9 members of a Gaza family apparently killed by mistake. Here again, presumptive, inaccurate. We will consider how the 9 members of the Gaza family died. They died in the home of one of Hamas's most belligerent and ruthless leaders. The man who has been essential to increasing the number of rockets being fired into Israel, and a man who plays a leading role in the kidnapping of Israelis. It was his hand, his home, that was blown up. Hamas political leader Khalid Mishal said that the morale in Gaza was high and that anyone who attacked Palestinians would be buried. Yes, in fact, there's even now thousands upon thousands of Egyptians that are marching into Gaza, screaming at their government to engage and begin an assault on Israel. All of the comments from the Muslim Brotherhood, mostly the chieftain of Egypt now, blame Israel as the aggressor, when they know full well that Israel is only responding to the rocket attacks inside of its territory. Imagine for a moment that you live in England and France decides to send 1,000 rockets across the channel. Do you think the English are going to stand there and have tea and say, hey, boys will be boys, let's not escalate this thing and respond? If you lived in Los Angeles and the Mexican government decided that they were going to call jihad against the United States and send 1,000 rockets into Los Angeles, would you ignore it or would you expect your government to respond? The political leader of Hamas was, went out and praised the resistance fighters. Now, there is no resistance fighter now in Gaza engaged in this. You have those who are firing rockets and the recipients of Israel's retaliation against the rockets. Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi said that an Israeli ground invasion would have serious repercussions, saying that Egypt would never accept it, neither would the free world. Of course, Egypt wouldn't accept it. They're on the side of the aggressors. They are former jihadists. Hamas grew out of the Muslim Brotherhood. It's a disciple, a descendant, an heir of the Muslim Brotherhood. Gaza militants launched 32 additional missiles into Israel already today, of which 4 were intercepted. 1 hit a school in the Israeli city of Ashkelon. Classes, however, had been canceled as a result of the escalating violence. Another hit a home. At least 9 children were killed in Gaza on Sunday, the bloodiest day so far, and TV reports showing horrific images of their burned and charred bodies have been fueling Palestinian anger, says the BBC's journalist there, who, by the way, is walking among the Muslims as a Muslim. Since the conflict began, there have been the killings on both sides. But understand, the exclusive reason that Hamas positions, its rockets, and its other weapons that they use against Israel in civilian areas is because they want Muslim children to die. Because when Muslim children die as a result of absolute necessity of Israel responding to the rockets, they then engender the rage of Muslims and the sympathy of the ignorant around the world. But also keep this in mind. On any given day in Syria, 10 times the number of Muslim children and civilians are killed by Muslim-on-Muslim violence. In any week in Iraq, the same thing occurs. Muslims kill Muslims in far greater quantity than do any other source of Islamic deaths. And also keep in mind, the only reason that this has flared up is because specifically the United States chose to aid and abet the militants in Libya, to arm them, and these are the very arms that are now being smuggled into Gaza through a supportive Egypt now that the Muslim Brotherhood has taken over Egypt. We are seeing the result of the Islamic Reformation, misnamed the Arab Spring. Also, because the United States stupidly invaded Iraq and gave Iraq to Iran, Iran is able to manufacture and ship to deliver more sophisticated and larger rockets into Gaza. We have made a mess of the world, and we are reaping what we have done. Now, as it relates to that, the members of one family who were buried under broken concrete and mangled metal, the Al-Qassam Brigades, which are a terrorist unit of Hamas, called it a massacre committed by Israeli occupation. Now, the Israeli airstrike was targeting Yahya Baya. Yahya Baya is a senior Hamas leader. He is a man who second only to the Hamas militant killed about a week ago, is the most responsible for kidnapping of Israelis and the increased rocket assault against Israel. The house that was destroyed was Baya's home. It was his command center. And the fact that a family was killed underneath it is just evidence that these Islamic terrorists hide beneath the skirts of their women. They hide behind the bodies of their own children. They are reprehensible. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. To Shattering Myths, if you'd like to engage in this discussion, our number is toll-free, 877-376-45. In a separate article, this one by Reuters, it concludes with the following comment. The United States and several of the score or more of European nations have put the brunt of the blame for the current crisis on Hamas, saying Israel has the right to self-defense, while Arab and Muslim nations, those are coterminous, there is no Arab nation that isn't a Muslim nation, have accused Israel of being the aggressor. To accuse Israel of being the aggressor, you have to be absolutely insane. You have to have lost all touch with reality. But such is the nature of religion, in particular Islam. This is really an issue of cause and effect. Cause and effect, making the connection between cause and effect, is the essence of exercising good judgment. It is the exercise. It's the essence of being moral. It is the essence of being sane, of being rational. When you lose the ability to associate cause and effect, as have most European countries, and has all Muslim nations, then you lose the ability to be moral, to be sane, to be rational, to exercise good judgment. It is a travesty, and this travesty is carried out in so many places and in so many ways, with religion, with military assaults, with political schemes, that the vast majority of people are lost. Speaking of not understanding what he is sliding into, Barack Obama became the first American president to visit Miramar, former Burma, on Monday. In recent months, however, the thing that he does not want to acknowledge is that the Buddhist and Muslim minority in the country have attacked one another, killing nearly 200 people just since the military lid was released from that country, that any time you weaken a leader in a country with an Islamic either majority or minority, things actually go from bad to worse. It's what's happened in Egypt. It's what's happened in Libya. It is what is on course to happen in Syria. It is what happened in Burma. Without a strong hand, and I'm not advocating dictators here, I'm just telling you this is the reality. Without a strong hand, Muslims respond aggressively, violently, and that is what is now plaguing Miramar. Now, the reality is that many in Miramar consider the Muslims to be illegal immigrants because they're leaving Bangladesh, but they're taking their Islam with them. They're leaving Bangladesh because as bad as Miramar has been, Bangladesh is worse because, of course, Bangladesh is exclusively Islamic. And so there have been a wave, an increased wave of sectarian, this would be Muslim on Buddhist and Buddhist now response, terrorist attacks that have shocked this nation. Obama announced during his trip, not dealing with this reality, just pretending that, you just all need to get along and everything will be fine, not recognizing or not caring that Islam has vowed to continue to wage war against non-Muslims until the whole world surrenders to Allah. Obama, also not recognizing that the United States is bankrupt, announced the resumption of a U.S. aid program in Miramar during his visit. An administration official said that U.S. aid program would include $170 million for the country for the remainder of this year and during next year. $170 million. It's obvious this president is out of touch with the economic reality of this nation. But rather than having to deal with congressmen and to try to avert the looming doom, President Barack Obama decided to take his debate to those corporate chieftains who embrace him, who support him, including J.P. Morgan's Chase, CEO Jamie Dimon, and the investor Warren Buffett. Dimon has been a harsh critic of tougher rules imposed on financial services industry, but last month backed Obama's goal of raising taxes on top wage earners, so that is why this president, rather than try to convince his opposition that he is right, chooses only to embrace those who worship him, who support him, who are beguiled by him. He also, on this trip, spoke with Apple's Tim Cook, Boeing's Jim McCurney, and Costco's Craig Jetlick, all supporters of the Obama administration. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. Wrote, when people find that they can vote themselves money, that will herald the end of the republic. And indeed, with this last election, America transitioned from the Declaration of Independence to the Declaration of Dependence. We have dedicated a number of programs, and we're going to continue presenting the collapse of the American economy. looking at periods of economic growth and the lower taxation policies that prompted them, and then examining periods of prolonged recession and depression, and considering the confiscation of wealth that precipitated these declines and also made them worse. We spent a considerable time considering the largest and most robust economic gains in American history that were the result of cutting the tax rates by two-thirds that led to the Roaring Twenties. And then we looked at what turned them sour and prolonged the Great Depression. It is little wonder that the Federal Reserve's contraction of the money supply turned the Great Depression, turned what was a recession into a Great Depression, an elongated depression under FDR. It is a myth to believe that FDR's New Deal led the U.S. out of economic collapse, although Americans are prone to accept myths, to believe myths. In fact, in an upcoming program, we're going to speak of the myth that is Abraham Lincoln, since there is the movie out that promotes the myth that Abraham Lincoln was the great emancipator, when in fact he was a racist. Just as it is a myth to believe that FDR's New Deal remedied economic collapse as opposed to making it worse. Because the reality is that FDR contributed to and elongated and deepened the recession and depression that he inherited. And there is, with FDR, a direct, irrefutable, and substantial connection between increasing taxation, debilitating deficits, and profound economic decline. And, of course, when it comes to creating the conditions upon which the populace can be beguiled into giving up their possessions and their freedoms, and to swallow political and patriotic propaganda as if it were their mother's milk, nothing beats war. As for the war being justified for the increased debt that started a legacy that America has never recovered from, the reality is that America had no business in the European theater of World War II. And an argument could be made that allying with Stalin's USSR left Europe worse than we found it under Hitler. And with Japan, one cannot justify sending 350,000 Americans to their death to avenge the aerial bombardment of 3,000, killing 3 million in the process, many of whom were non-combatants and had nothing to do with the war. America suffered its first post-war recession immediately following the war in 1945, when the decline in government spending at the end of World War II led to an enormous drop in gross domestic product. This was the result of the government controlling business and being the biggest spender to a more private-driven economy. The contraction was 13%. Today, the federal government represents 25% of GDP, and so we have returned to the position that we were during the war. In 1946, the deficit was $55 billion, which is revealing because there was no war, and at the time there was a 91% tax rate on the most productive Americans. So with a 91% tax rate on the most productive Americans and no war to fund, the federal deficit was $55 billion. But in 1947, Republicans would gain control of Congress, and deficits were turned into surpluses of $50 billion and $25 billion, respectively. The top tax rate continued above 90% from 1948 through 1963. During this time, Democrats controlled Congress 13 of those 14 years, where money is appropriated, of course. And during much of this time, the president was a general with no business experience or economic conviction of any kind. There were two modest surpluses during the period, with deficits ranging upwards of $30 million per year for most of the 13 to 15 years. As a fact, for several decades, the U.S. national debt hovered between $250 and $350 billion. It was growing very modestly during that period. It wasn't until LBJ's Great Society programs, the advent of Medicaid and Medicare, and his wealth redistribution policies that caused so many Americans to become dependent upon their government, that our debt crisis was exacerbated. Now, during this time of high taxation and gradually increasing deficits, there were five recessions. So this was not a time of consistent growth, which is how it is presented. In 1945, we had 5% unemployment and 13% economic contraction. In 1949, there was 8% unemployment and 2% economic contraction. Then in 1953, so we're dealing with 4 years and 4 years again. So 4 years later in 1953, 6% unemployment and 3% economic contraction. 5 years later in 1958, 8% unemployment and 4% economic contraction. And then just 2 years later in 1960, 7% unemployment and 2% economic contraction. So during these post-war years, there was a direct, irrefutable, and substantial connection between very high tax rates at over 90% on the most productive Americans, growing deficits, although they grew slowly, and recessions, which were extraordinarily frequent, one occurring every 3 to 5 years. In fiscal year 1964-65, the tax rate on the highest wage earners was decreased from 91% to 77%, producing a reduction in the increase to the deficit of $19 billion to $17 billion. The top rate was lowered again, this time from 77% to 70% in 1966, which led to having the deficit cut in half from $17 billion to $8 billion. The data remains consistent. Lower taxes equal lower deficits. Further, during this period, the nation's economy grew 9 consecutive years. This was the longest time of continual economic expansion since the 1920s, all as a direct result because taxes were lowered. To be fair, economic growth in the shadow of a democratically controlled Congress was constrained. But the country did better when taxes were lowered. And this peppering of recessions every 3 to 5 years finally abated when the government stopped confiscating such a high percentage of its citizens' earnings. With Democrats now in complete control of all three branches of government from 1961 to 1968, the U.S. engaged in two very counterproductive wars, both very different wars, making things worse for the country we invaded and for those we sent in to evade it, which was Vietnam, and also for Americans in terms of LBJ's war against poverty. Greater spending on the Vietnam conflict and on LBJ's war on poverty drove higher deficits in 1967 of $19 billion and in 1968 of $61 billion, all with Democrats controlling all three branches of government. The moral of the story is don't trust politicians, the media, or generals, and don't go to war. And it was these wars which led to the downturn of 1969, with 6% unemployment and a 0.6% contraction of the U.S. economy. When a nation goes to war, bad things happen. And such is the case with the Vietnam War. And keep in mind that while these kinds of wars typically rally a nation around its president and elicit patriotic fever, the reality is that most wars that America has fought have been voluntary. Most have been started based upon outright lies, and most have been counterproductive. Now, the deficit dropped to $17 billion in 1969, which was Nixon's first year, but rose steadily as a result of the democratically controlled House and Senate and because of the spending programs that had been brought in by LBJ to $44 billion, $67 billion, $69 billion, and $70 billion from 1969 to 1972. Now, there was a steady drumbeat upwards. This time of reasonably de minimis growth in the deficits was over. It was now, rather than growing $1 billion to $10 billion a year, it was now growing $44, $67, $69, and $70 billion a year. During this time, the top tax rate remained at a confiscatory 70%. And at this rate, the nation endured another recession, this one in late 1973, enduring through 1975 with 9% unemployment and 3% economic contraction. Worst of all, inflation was now out of control because the nation had so inflated its currency to fund its growing debt, it had lost a considerable portion of its value. OPEC and Vietnam exacerbated out-of-control government spending, derived from the political liberal Great Society programs launched during the 1960s under LBJ and the Democrat Congress. Rising inflation became epidemic. It's the lingering curse of both war and deficits. Now, the deficit in 1973 under Richard Nixon dropped from $70 billion to $34 billion, only to triple the next 2 years as a result of higher interest rates to $108 billion and $153 billion. That kind of increase, doubling, tripling the debt, is what we're going to see in the very near future in America. Because when you deficit spend, you devalue your currency because you have to print money out of nothing, money that is ultimately based on debt, to retire, to fund that debt, and when you do so, you destroy the value of your currency, and when you do that, you create inflation, and when you do that, you drive up interest rates. And so it shall be what Nixon and America endured, trying to pay the higher interest on the accumulated debt that drove up the deficit even further. And it is what America is about ready to endure. Now, we're going to turn our attention to 1976 when we return to Shattering Myths in a moment, where Democrats gain complete control of Capitol Hill. Hello, welcome back to the final segment of the news hour of Shattering Myths. We'll turn to Yah's testimony in the second hour. We are reviewing the history of economics in the United States to skewer the myth that the way that you resolve the deficit and the way that you resolve issues of economic decline is to tax the highest wage earners more, when history says that the exact opposite is true. So since this last election was a debate on that subject, and since the entire discussion on the fiscal cliff is a debate as to what to do with tax rates vis-a-vis the deficit and government spending, it's important to know our history. Now, we're not going to complete this review in this program, but another couple of days, and I think we will make our way through the material so that we all are in a position to understand the facts. Because it is only when you understand, or I should say, know the facts, it's only when you know the facts you're in a position to understand what's actually happening. And when you understand what's happening, you can exercise good judgment. So anyway, Democrats gained complete control of Capitol Hill in 1976 once again with the election of Jimmy Carter, and deficits clocked in at $103 billion, $112 billion, $76 billion, $98 billion, and $99 billion from 76 through fiscal year 1980-81. And so what had been deficits in the $10 billion range, even less, year after year, sometimes as little as $5 billion, we're now $100 billion. At this time, so they had increased 20-fold, all as a direct result of what happened during the short tenure of LBJ. At this time, interest rates, as a consequence of runaway inflation, created what was called a misery index that neared 30%. The highest tax rate remained at 70%. As a result, there was another recession in 1980 and 81, with 8% unemployment rising ultimately to 11% and a 2% contraction that grew to a 3%. The Fed raised interest rates dramatically as a result of runaway inflation causing the downturn. The Fed also deployed tight monetary policy, restricting growth. But then came what was known as the Reagan Revolution in 1981, with the first implementation of supply-side economics since the Roaring Twenties. The top tax bracket was instantly lowered from 70% to 50% in his first term, and then from 50 to 28% in his second term. The recession ended and America grew. But something was different this time. Reagan talked a good game, but he was a big spender, especially on defense. So while the government's revenues grew on lower tax rates, and while the economy flourished and jobs were created in record numbers, the deficit grew as a result of runaway spending. In 1982, the deficit rose from $100 billion to $149 billion, and then to $236 billion in 1983, dipping to $187 billion in 84, only to increase again to $233 billion and $283 billion in 85 and 86. Now, to be fair, with Democrats and Republicans sharing control of the Congress and Senate, much of the Reagan deficits were attributable to FGA's legacy, Medicare, Medicaid, and increased social welfare programs. So now the trend, which was once absolutely clear, is a bit muddled. And it's not muddled on the tax size. If you lower taxes, you increase government revenues. It's now muddled because decreasing taxes doesn't always now lead to lowering the deficit, although during this time the deficit increased only because spending outpaced everything. We are going to, in a moment, begin a review systematically of what happened in every year, going all the way back to LBJ's Great Society days, where we're going to examine the specifics so that you are armed with facts to effectively come to a proper understanding of our most recent economic period of decline. Reagan's second term, and throughout the term of King George I, Democrats controlled America's checkbook. They controlled Congress. And the deficits associated with the new welfare state that America was creating continued to mount. We have Reagan spending, and Reagan and the Democratic Congress spending 22.4% of GDP and raising revenues that amounted to 18.2% of GDP, creating a 4% gap. Bush then exacerbated this problem, which we will examine in a future program on Shattering Myths. I am Yada. Join us for the second hour as we consider Yah's Torah teaching.
Alex Jones here with a message that could revolutionize health in this country. Going back about a year and a half ago, I began to learn about the incredible health effects